This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we take a look at hospital rating systems and learn how to make sense of them. And what does it mean to have chest pain, and what should you do about it? But first, we'll explore bariatric weight loss surgery from the patient's perspective. Bariatric surgery holds great promise for those obese patients who have not been successful losing weight, using countless other methods of diet and exercise to achieve those results. But it's not a magic ticket to sustained weight loss, and there are many challenges and changes that each patient must face following surgery. So here with more on this are Jessica Charbonneau, a licensed clinical social worker at Upstate Medical University, and Carol Brzozowski, a bariatric surgery patient. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So Jessica, let's start with you. There are so many challenges and changes that each patient faces post-surgery. From your perspective, what do you think are the principal issues?
I think one of the biggest challenges that people face post-bariatric surgery is learning that awareness of hunger and fullness, awareness of if they think they're hungry, why are they hungry? Is it truly stomach hunger? Is it something else? And if it is something else, like stress, anxiety, depression, boredom, there's a lot of reasons we eat other than being hungry. If it's one of those, then having awareness, gaining awareness of what else you can do to alleviate those uncomfortable emotions other than eat. So a lot of it is gaining mindfulness and awareness, learning how to be aware of what our body's really telling us.
And in a sense, is that something that perhaps wasn't developed sufficiently prior to, so that they weren't successful before in weight loss? So this is something that needs to continue to develop.
I think truthfully it's something that we all need to develop, because I think as a society there's lots of reasons that we are not always mindful, but I think it's especially important after bariatric surgery, because the surgery itself, I think, helps to control a lot of the stomach hunger, the true stomach hunger, and it helps to...
Where the feelings of fullness are there because the stomach has been basically made smaller.
Right, there's a lot of restriction, and so you're not necessarily going to overeat immediately after surgery. You're probably not going to be eating large quantities of food, but if you are not aware of that hunger, fullness, and those other reasons that we eat, then potentially people could get into a bad habit that, like grazing, we call it grazing.
And I think it's important to know that that some people, after bariatric surgery, do gain weight. Even if they have to eat in small amounts at a time, they can continue to graze throughout a day and actually gain weight.
Right.
So that's key. Carol, you've had the surgery.
I have.
So your perspective is crucial here. Tell us about your experience.
I had many attempts at losing weight. I twice lost more than 100 pounds and gained them back.
Wow.
So I'm one of those people. I teased that I had Weight Watchers on retainer. I literally had was paying the monthly fee without going to classes and without going to even going to the computer to check in, though I thought of myself as a Weight Watcher. So I think I was actually very successful in losing weight. What I was not successful at was keeping it off.
Yeah, and that's a common story, isn't it?
I think it is.
Yeah. So post-surgery, what was it like to undergo the surgery? And then what was the new you like?
Well, that's the question of the day. I had the surgery 3 years ago. I've been successful in changing my BMI from 56 to between 24 and 25.
Wow.
I've lost 90% of my excess weight.
Wow.
And kept it off now for about a year and a half. The bulk of the weight came off in the first year and a half. I've been successful in taking little bits of it off, and I have gained a little bit, but not so much that I've been scared about it. And I think one of the things that's helped me is to learn how to be more mindful, and I think that is critical. I tease my surgeon that I needed him for 45 minutes, but I've needed the nutritionist and my therapist
yeah.
for the last 4 years.
Well, that makes the most sense.
It does.
Because obviously your relationship to food has to be the thing that changes, and your relationship
to yourself
and how you approach, whether it's stress or other issues, you need to really have worked those through, it seems to me, to be able to have that control.
I think that's
control.
True. I started an aggressive exercise program 6 months before I had the surgery, and I have maintained an aggressive exercise program. I sold my car.
Wow.
And
that's pretty aggressive.
Try really hard to commute by walking or by bike. Haven't been so successful at that in the last 2 months when it's been so cold, but I've started a running program, so I've been able to keep my aerobic health up, and I've also started taking Pilates. I didn't have an exercise program before because I was in pain, and so to have, you know, chronic hip and knee and joint pain made it really difficult, not to mention my self-image issues and going to a gym. So
the weight itself it prevented you in a way from taking a more aggressive action towards exercise and then perhaps helping you with weight.
Absolutely. And I'm the first person to tell you that a fat person going to the gym is not necessarily a welcome person. Mm. And that was also a really difficult kind of thing. It's not a health club of certain kinds, but I tried to fit in gyms, and it's not always a welcome situation.
That's very interesting. That's very, very interesting. I'm not sure people would think that ordinarily, but obviously that's your experience.
I think that that's another whole topic, is the perception of fat discrimination. I'm here to tell you that people treat me very differently as a right-sized person compared to the way I was treated when I was morbidly obese.
Wow. That's very significant. Did you have other health issues prior to the surgery, and what has happened since?
I did. I was taking medication for... I was struggling with diabetes. I wasn't aggressively in the disease, but I was struggling there.
So you were like there.
Pre-diabetic, struggling with some high blood sugars and the effects of that, high blood pressure, cholesterol, depression. And so medicated for all of those things. And I currently take vitamins.
That's it.
Yeah.
So the surgery resolved the diabetes.
Yes,
or
did.
The pre-diabetes.
Correct.
And
in fact, I struggle in the opposite because I'm so active. I've been, my primary care physician and I have been mapping my low blood sugar because I find that, especially late in the day, if I'm not careful about protein before a bike ride home that's 3 to 5 miles, that I can sometimes plummet in my blood sugar, and that's an issue.
Wow.
So I have to do the opposite now.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with licensed clinical social worker Jessica Charbonneau and bariatric surgery patient Carol Brzozowski. And we're talking about bariatric surgery from her perspective, from a patient's perspective. So what do you think helped you the very most in terms of keeping the weight off?
I honestly think it's a shift in my self-image and being able to accept myself and feel like I deserve to be healthy and that I deserve to have a different kind of life. And I think that that came about through the really careful care of my nutritionist and therapist. I tried other kinds of therapy prior to this, but I think the cognitive behavioral therapy that Jessica practices and that other people practice around addiction issues, I was a food addict, am a food addict. I tried OA, which was successful for me, and other things, but something about the key to changing my self-image and the way that I fit into space and time, the way you feel in a space as a physical person and a person is what's helped me stay on track, the acceptance of that, and that's been helped by the therapy.
So Jessica, tell us a little bit about the CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy that you do, and tell us about, revisit this mindful thing.
Sure. So
define it.
Sure. Yeah. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a very popular evidence-based form of therapy that has to do with looking at how we think about life and patterns that we get into, because generally speaking, we tend to be creatures of habit, and we often have patterns, behavioral patterns in the way that we do things in life, and then also cognitive patterns in the way that we think about life. So sometimes those patterns serve us well, and sometimes they don't serve us well. And so cognitive behavioral therapy is about looking at what we're doing, and if it's not serving us well, maybe there's a different way of doing it.
So you know? You can change the way perhaps mm-hmm. you think about things, and what Carol was saying, the way she sees herself, thinks about herself, mm-hmm. and there are actual ways to do that, reinforcing certain mm-hmm. more positive patterns,
right.
thought patterns. But let's get to this mindful eating. Mindfulness is a phrase that's been used a lot in the last, I'd say, 20...
It's becoming very popular,
20
yes.
years mm-hmm. or longer. I know Jon Kabat-Zinn wrote about it many, many, many mm-hmm. years ago. But the whole idea here is that we are in the moment. We are aware of what we're doing, fully and totally aware of mm-hmm. ourselves in a moment in time. Mm-hmm. So we are using our mind fully for the moment. Mm-hmm. How does that relate to food and eating?
Well, I think for a lot of people, the reason that we overconsume is because we aren't really in the moment. We are eating on the go while we're driving our car, while we're checking our email, while we're doing many, we're multitasking, so we're not really in the moment. And so it's easy to miss some of those hunger fullness cues that our body does a really good job sending us. We just don't always receive them. So it's easy to, you know, I may pack a lunch and it may be a very perfectly portioned sandwich and fruit and beverage, but the truth is, if I'm just eating until the sandwich is gone because I'm checking my email or I'm taking a phone call, and I really was full two-thirds of the way through that sandwich or lunch, then that's not really being mindful. So it's important, I think, to be aware of how hungry we are, how full we are, to slow down and enjoy our food. Part of it is, you know, if we are really mindful, then we enjoy our food more. We need less of whatever it is to satisfy us. And then I think there's also benefit in being aware of what our body's telling us as far as what we want to eat, what we need to eat, because if we're mindful, then we can satisfy some of those cravings that we all have with a little bit less amount of food too. So there's a lot of benefit in being aware of what we're eating.
I didn't know that I was hungry because I never was hungry. I was so constant about my snacking, my eating, that I had a really hard time post-surgery recognizing hunger cues like headache or other kinds of physical cues because I'd never felt them before.
Wow.
And I don't think I'm alone in that as someone who has an eating disorder.
So food really took on, like you said, and it was comfort, but it was almost, you were almost addicted
Absolutely.
To eating for the sake of eating.
Absolutely.
And what practical advice, in the very little time we have left, very little time, what practical advice would you offer fellow bariatric patients? What helped you the most?
What helped me the most was to be honest and rely on people, that this was going to be the most important change that I'd made in the decade from, you know, maybe different, having children or something, but, right? Being honest with the people around you that this is going to change everyone's life around you, and it's going to be hard. It's not easy.
So it wasn't simply the surgery. It's really a total transformation of the way you approach
lifestyle.
Food and life.
Lifestyle.
And exercise and all the
exercise.
Whole wellness
and
all
get
around.
Get a great therapist.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for coming in and sharing all these insights with us. Let's hope you inspire some other people out there who are listening. My guests have been Jessica Charbonneau, a licensed clinical social worker at Upstate Medical University, and Carol Berzowski, a bariatric surgery patient. Coming up next, what do hospital ratings really mean, and how can we make sense of them? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. As healthcare consumers, we are forever hearing hospitals claim, we're the top hospital in emergency care or ranked number one in pulmonary medicine. But what exactly do these ratings, rankings, and claims actually mean? We'll hear with some insight into all of this is Dr. Anthony Weiss. He's the Chief Medical Officer and Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Weiss. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So there's all these claims out there. For example, I just read that U.S. News and World Report releases its annual list of the best hospitals, I guess, on a regular basis and annually. But what does that actually mean? I mean, what does it mean for patients, and what does it tell us about American healthcare?
Well, I think it's been a fascinating transition over the last several years. In the past, many people had firsthand experience with the physicians or the people that were providing care for them. And increasingly, physicians are not the ones, your own personal physician is not the one who's looking over you in the hospital.
You mean with the advent of hospitalists, for example?
That's exactly right. And so most of the people receiving care within the hospital are being cared for, frankly, by complete strangers. And so how do we convey a sense of trust to the people who are receiving care within the hospital? And how do people who receive care from different places, whether that's outpatient or inpatient, feel comfortable with their health care? And I think trust is really at the basis of these kind of rankings and the real push to develop measures related to hospitals. And in part, it's because we've lost that sense of personal trust with our own family doctor, and now it's more institutionally based trust.
How many rating systems actually exist?
You know, it's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that.
But there's a variety of I'm always seeing all of these alphabet, like alphabet soup.
There are many of them, and in some ways they're like the good housekeeping seal for healthcare, and I think that's the aim of several of these measures. I'm not sure that any has really achieved the kind of status of the good housekeeping seal. I'm not sure that there's one that's risen to the top in terms of a single measure that people can look at and feel as though this is what I'm looking for and I can trust that the care I'm going to get here is high-quality care.
What troubles me is it can it often just be a marketing tool, for example, or a way of promoting a hospital rather than it really being something that's credible?
Well, I don't know that it's specifically a marketing tool, and it depends on which ratings you're looking at. But there are real data that stand behind these ratings. Now, whether those data really are representative of the type of care any particular patient is going to be seeking is another matter entirely. So, for example, some of the ratings may be focused on surgical mortality or what we call morbidity, complications after certain surgeries. Well, that may or may not be important if you're seeking obstetric care or if you're seeking outpatient care related to rheumatoid arthritis or another condition.
So it doesn't tell the whole story.
It very well may not tell the whole story. Now, one area that I'm particularly interested in is in patient experience. And so you're seeing a number of measures specifically related to what is the experience of patients seeking care within the hospital or within the outpatient setting. And those are the type of data that I really think are valuable and potentially of interest and value to patients themselves.
Rather than a particular rating, it's the gathering of that data and then it's somehow being made available to prospective patients?
That's right. I think it's not only the gathering and the dissemination to patients, but it's also the nature of the data. So rather than focusing on the internal machinations of was the antibiotic given at the right moment, these ratings are looking at what was the overall experience of care within that hospital. So, for example, Press-Ganey, or what we call HCAHPS.
Tell us more about that. What's Press-Ganey? What does that mean?
Well, Press-Ganey is a company, of course, and they've created a series of tools that are surveys. So many patients now, after they've been hospitalized or even after an outpatient visit, will get a phone call or a message saying that we're interested in your experience. And a large proportion of those are related to Press-Ganey. We at Upstate and at many hospitals now take those very seriously. And there are different questions that are asked, questions about what was your overall experience? How did doctors communicate with you? How was the communication from nursing? How was your pain managed? These are all very important questions. The one that I look at the most is, would you recommend the hospital to another person? And I think this, again, gets back to that concept of trust. So if I know that most people are recommending this, well, I may not have personal experience with that hospital or that clinic, but if it looks like many people recommend that hospital or clinic, I can then trust that I'm going to receive a similar type of care there.
In some ways, it's not unlike getting a word-of-mouth recommendation to a physician in town from a neighbor or a friend who's had a very positive experience.
I think it's a great analogy, and I think that's what we all look for. You know, when we're trying to find a restaurant in a new city, and
right.
I'm new here myself, so this is something that's top of mind for me right now. You know, we need to feel that we can trust that restaurant and make sure that we're not going to go away sick. And who better to get the recommendation from than someone that you personally know? Now, if I don't personally know someone who's been to the restaurants here in Syracuse, well, then I'll probably look to another source. And those sources would be people who have been to the restaurant and can recommend it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Anthony Weiss, and we're talking about making sense of hospital ratings and what criteria are really important. Well, does the data really tell the complete story, though?
I don't think so. And, you know, I think in many ways I do look at the data, especially the Prescani and the HCAHPS results. And so I do think it's important for patients who receive care to be honest and open about the surveys they receive and know that those have an important bearing on how we're delivering care. But I also know that I cannot just sit in my office here at Upstate and really get a sense of what's going on in the hospital itself. And I think most people need to experience care for themselves. And as the chief medical officer here, I need to go out to the floors, talk to physicians and nurses, and talk to patients.
Well, you've just made the perfect segue, because you also alluded to the fact that you've recently joined the faculty. So tell us where you came from and, you know, what exactly is your role?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm originally from Wisconsin, born and raised, went to school in Wisconsin, and then over the last 17 years, I've been in Boston at Massachusetts General Hospital. My training was in psychiatry, and I started really psychiatric research, doing brain imaging, and began to get more interested in how research is actually applied in clinical practice. And that led to the growing area of healthcare quality and patient safety, which in the earlier part of the last decade was just starting to get off the ground with work by Don Berwick and Lucien Leap and Brent James and others. And I had an opportunity to study with Dr. James out in Salt Lake City. And from that work and other work at Mass General, continued on from mental health quality into broader areas of hospital quality.
And so you have come here to Upstate with a particular mission in mind. Tell us more about that, because you alluded to the fact that you're going out into the wards and trying to gather this very valuable information about patient care. Tell us what your mission is.
Yeah, so I'm excited to be here as the first chief medical officer here at Upstate. And the role of the chief medical officer is to really serve as a bridge between clinicians of the hospital and the leadership of the hospital, and making sure that the care overall is of high quality and that patients are receiving the kind of care that we would want for family members, frankly. And so to be able to do that, I need to work with clinicians and more or less clear away the barriers that might be in place for them to provide the kind of care that they all have been trained to do.
And in that role, are you also interacting with patients? I mean, or at least, as you said, you're looking at patient data.
So I do some clinical work here. I still continue to do some work as a psychiatrist in the general medical and surgical services, doing consult psychiatry. But the vast majority of my time is focused on administrative work for the hospital. And part of that is rounding on the floors of the hospital, talking to patients, and then getting a sense of what their experience has been like from surveys like Prescani and from other surveys. For example, we do post-discharge phone calls where we ask people about their experience and ask if there are any unresolved issues, and we review those as well.
So basically, Upstate and probably other institutions use these kinds of measures that we've been talking about, the surveys at least, as springboards or catalysts for quality improvement.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that they're a goldmine for learning about ways in which the organization can improve, and learning about ways in which, you know, frankly, we're doing a good job. And I think that in all hospitals, there are areas of the hospital that are high achieving, and there are areas of the hospital that, you know, we could do better at. And looking at those areas where we could do better, trying to understand, is this related to communication? Is this related to our response to pain needs? What are the barriers to providing really high quality service? Those are the areas that we're really focusing on. And it's not just UpState. I think many hospitals now are really being driven to look at patient experience in a whole new light.
Especially, I think, since the advent of the hospitalist, I think your initial point that you made to me is really spot on. Because at one time, you had attending physicians who were community physicians who would follow their patients into the hospital, oversee their care, visit with them on a regular basis, round on them and all of this. And today, it's a very different picture. How long has that been true?
Really is. The hospitalist model started in the early part of the last decade and has grown exponentially since then. And you're starting to see nocturnists, physicians who only work at night, intensivists, physicians that only work in the intensive care units. And in large part, it's because medicine has become so specialized, and the idea of being a generalist outpatient physician and then also being expert in inpatient care is becoming more and more difficult to achieve.
Do you think with the increase in technology and some of the advances in medicine that it's become more complicated to be able to do it all, so to speak?
I think that's true. I think in part it's related to technology, in part it's advances, as you say, in the care that we are providing within the hospital. And I think in part it's related to pressures brought to bear on hospitalizations. Length of stay are shorter than they used to be. There are a lot more, even what I would say, non-medical aspects to providing care within the hospital, making sure you're coordinating services for discharge and aftercare, as an example. And unless you're working on those issues almost on a daily basis, it can be hard to get up to speed, so to speak.
Yeah, in this climate of a rush to cut costs, so to speak, because of the high cost of hospital care, it seems that it's a lot of pressure on the clinical side of things in terms of patient care delivery, healthcare delivery in the inpatient setting.
I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, we don't want to keep people in the hospital longer than they want to be, you know, and I think for the most part, people don't want to sleep in the hospital. And so I think that's also part of it. And what used to take 2 weeks now is, you know, sometimes even done
overnight
or not at all. Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming into it, just coming to talk to us today. When it comes right down to it, is the best takeaway that you need to know your own hospital wherever you live?
I think that's an important takeaway. And I think you're going to see increased exposure of these kind of patient experience values. And I think better use of these kind of data moving forward.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Anthony Weiss. He's the Chief Medical Officer and Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs at UpState Medical University. Very interesting information, and we're so glad to have you on board.
Glad to be here. Thank you so much.
I'm Linda Cohen, and this is UpState's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's Checkup from the Neck Up, Anxiety to Excitement, or Sing Along with Me. Well, folks, I love it. New research shows that telling ourselves to get excited rather than to calm down can lower our anxiety and improve our performance during typical anxiety-arousing activities, including our number one fear, public speaking, and on a math test, and doing karaoke, public singing. How did they change anxiety into excitement? Well, before public speaking, for example, folks were instructed to say out loud, "I'm excited," or "I'm calm." People pointing their brains to excitement spoke longer, were rated as more persuasive, competent, and relaxed than those who said they were calm. And similar results in the other two situations, better math test scores and better pitch, rhythm, and volume in the karaoke. Why? Well, perhaps because the high physical arousal, dubbed anxiety, triggers thoughts of potential threat and avoidance reactions that take our attention off the task. But telling ourselves that that same pounding heart is excitement may trigger thoughts of potential opportunities and aim our attention and energy to performing well for success. Too good to be true? How about we see if it works? First, my own relevant psychological history. As a kid, I loved to sing. But in high school, our chorus class teacher pulled me aside and whispered to me, "When we perform for the school, stand next to another bass who sings loudly and sings softly." And in college music class, the prof pointed out what a wide range my voice has and asked the class if I should become a professional singer. Shrieks, guffaws, and a riotous no, bass to soprano. So public singing anxiety ever since. But I know I'm not alone. And if you quietly harbor a bit of vocal trepidation, want to see if we can break free by pointing our brains to excitement and warbling with relish? Yes? Ready? "I'm excited, I'm excited, I'm excited." Start spreading the news. Leaving anxious today. I want to be done with it. New me, new me. These excited shoes are longing to stray right through the pounding heart of it. New me, new me. I wanna wake up in a city that never sleeps and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap. These little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in new me. If I can make it here, I'll make it anywhere. It's up to me. New me, new me. Frank, you got nothing on me. I'm Dr. Rich, Excited Man O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Next up, what causes chest pain and what should we do about it? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine, with your Healthy Monday Minute for March 3rd. Fitness can be free. You don't need an expensive gym membership or fancy equipment to get active. Exercise is any movement that works your muscles and uses more energy than resting. Try walking around your neighborhood, playing tag with the kids, using resistance bands, running up and down the stairs, making your own weights at home, or doing push-ups and sit-ups. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, there are probably few scarier symptoms that one can experience than chest pain. And these days, both men and women are acutely aware that heart attacks come with little warning and do not discriminate on the basis of gender. So what should you do, and what do you need to know when you experience chest pain? Here with some answers is Dr. William Paolo. He's Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine and the Residency Program Director at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Paolo.
Thanks for coming in.
So chest pain is more common than most people think. I guess it's somewhat of a common symptom. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's correct. We see chest pain for any number of causes, some of which are very benign and some which are not. But at any point in time, at least 25% of people will experience chest pain throughout the year. And it's one of the number one causes of people to visit the emergency department.
Wow. So it can be caused not just for cardiac reasons, I guess problems with your lungs, problems with your muscles, ribs, nerves. Tell us about
that. Yeah, that's correct. When we break down causes of chest pain that we see in the emergency department, we really divide it into those that are serious and those that are not. And in the serious causes, there are three that we always think about every time you have chest pain, and that's a heart attack, or what we call ACS, which is acute coronary syndrome. It's kind of a catch-all for any kind of heart attack that you can have. Pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot that starts somewhere else, usually in your legs or in your thighs, and then goes to the lung itself. And an aortic dissection, which is a very fancy term for a kind of a tear through the main artery that leaves your heart and goes down to the rest of your body. So those are the dangerous causes. Then we have some urgent causes, some things that are really we need to see you for, but aren't as life-threatening as those. Those can be something like pericarditis. Lining your heart, around your heart, is what we call the pericardial sac. It's a soft tissue lining around your heart. After viral syndromes, and in some people with rheumatological conditions like lupus or Sjogren syndrome, they can get inflammation of that sac. And that feels really painful to them, and they can have a cough and whatnot. In addition, you can get inflammation around your lungs, which we call pleurisy. And then there are some other more benign causes like reflux or costochondritis that we can see as well.
So when you say reflux, yeah, just let me stop you for a moment. So reflux has to do more with some kind of acid coming back up into the esophagus from the stomach?
Yeah, that's right. It was what we call gastroesophageal reflux disease. So that's some people have the sphincter that controls how tight it is between your esophagus and your stomach, and some people can be loosened. So after eating a big meal or a spicy meal, they may experience some burning and some foul taste in the back of their mouth. Some people with that can get what we call esophageal spasm. The acid irritates the esophagus to the point that they feel this kind of spasmodic pain in their chest. And that's tough to distinguish between that and heart attacks. Unless we knew in the past that they had that. So if you're having that newly, we always want to see you in the emergency department because we can't tell just from the symptoms which is which.
And that's, I think that's the critical part here. Let's get a little bit more clear about the kind of, what does it feel like, for example?
Sure.
What are the various types of feelings that come along with chest pain?
Okay.
I mean, what kind of a pain is it?
Well, let's talk about the heart attack chest pain. Heart attack chest pain is very difficult to really define. Part of why that is because your heart doesn't have the same kind of nerves that your skin does. With your skin, when you have pain, you can very much tell where that is, and you can pinpoint where that is. And that's called somatic pain. When you have heart pain or pain in your organs, it's innervated by a different system. It's called visceral pain. So it's very vague, it's very nonspecific, and you can't quite tell.
More generalized.
More generalized. So sometimes you'll feel like it's in the middle of your chest. Sometimes you'll feel it's up in your neck. But some of the things that we worry about that particularly point to a heart attack are chest pain. The classic, though not always defined this way, symptom is feeling like pressure or something is sitting on your chest. They describe it almost like an elephant is sitting on my chest.
Like a crushing sensation.
Like a crushing
squeezing.
Sensation. Yeah. What we call substernal, so in the middle of the chest, though it can be in the left or the right side. Some people know that the heart is on the left side, but you can still have heart attack pain on the right side.
Really?
That's correct. In addition, we look for associated symptoms. So I have chest pain plus I'm sweating. I have chest pain plus I'm nauseous. Or I have chest pain plus it goes up into my neck or goes straight through to my back.
And those would be more indicative of a heart attack?
Those are more concerning for a heart attack. Certainly the associated symptoms, what we would call nausea, shortness of breath, or sweating. If those occur along with chest pain, then we're really worried about a heart attack or a more serious cause than, say, reflux disease. You can certainly see some of that if you have really bad reflux disease, but I wouldn't just assume it is. I'd rather prove it's not one of the more dangerous causes.
So how about things like you were talking about a moment ago, something like a pneumothorax, but pneumonia or a pulmonary embolism?
Yes.
Those will lead to somewhat similar types of pain symptoms?
It can. So classically, when we talk about a pulmonary embolism, again, this is a blood clot that travels to your lungs. What people complain of is what we call pleuritic chest pain. And what that is, it means it hurts when I take a deep breath.
Okay.
When I take a deep breath
in,
it feels like I can't take that full deep breath in and it stops me. I'm sure a lot of people have experienced, if you've ever had a pulled rib or a torn intercostal muscle, it's that same kind of pain, that pain that when I take a deep breath in, it immediately hurts and I have to stop myself from breathing in. A pneumothorax, which you refer to, a collapsed lung, usually we see that in a bunch of different things, but we can see them in very tall, skinny people. And what they have are what we call blebs, or these little air-filled pockets at the top of the lungs. And when you breathe deeply, sometimes they can pop and then rupture a lung. That's what we call spontaneous pneumothorax, as opposed to one in trauma. And they come in with sudden onset. That's the key thing for them. Sudden onset of chest pain and shortness of breath. there's different things that we time by how the symptoms started. Did it start gradually and then get worse, or did it start suddenly and at the beginning it hurt the most?
If you were suffering from a heart attack, would you also have shortness of breath? Or is the shortness of breath more to do with when the lungs are involved?
No, it doesn't have to do with the lungs. You can have shortness of breath with a heart attack in and of itself. There's a number of different things that can cause that. Sometimes when you have a heart attack, because the part of the heart muscle is dying, it can't pump the blood forward as well. So some of that blood and that pressure can back up and cause some fluid to build up in the lungs. So we can see it from that, and you can just see it from just having the associated symptoms of a heart attack. You can feel short of breath or air starving, kind of what we call dyspnea. I'm feeling like I need to breathe deeper and I'm not getting enough breath in.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. William Paolo. We're talking about chest pain, which is more commonly occurring, I guess, than we ever thought. I mean, you said 25% of people in America will experience chest pain. And what we're trying to get down to is, when is it serious and when is it not? I guess, is there any time that you experience chest pain that you could say to someone, don't worry about it?
There are a couple of ways, but it's very difficult to define that. So if you have reflux, and you know you have reflux, and this is the same symptom as your reflux always, that is more comfortable.
Is that a particular type of pain associated with? In other words, it's chest pain, but could it be a burning sensation as opposed to the pressure?
With a foul taste in the back of your mouth. Again, there are those people who experience esophageal spasm who may, in fact, get the pressure type sensation, but they should know that they have that, and this should be the same type of pain that they've had in the past. Much of the same when we talk about angina. Angina is just a fancy term for chest pain, and what we're really saying is ischemia, or not enough blood going to the heart. And we quantify that in two ways. We call one unstable angina, when I have new pain or pain that I've never had before, or stable angina. And stable angina means I have a little blockage in my heart, I don't get enough blood, I get pain when I exert myself, I get pain when I go up and down the stairs, but this is the pain I always have and it hasn't changed from the past.
And that in and of itself is not the kind of concern that requires an emergency
visit. No, not if you know you've had it and you've been diagnosed by your primary doctor as having stable angina. When we call it unstable is if you've had stable angina and then your symptoms change. This pain is unlike what I've had before. This pain occurred when I was sitting down watching TV. That's when we worry about it.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
But for the most part, what we see with the different angina symptoms and with the different chest pain symptoms is that if you have new chest pain and you've never had this kind of chest pain before, we worry about it enough to want to see you and at least do some basic tests.
More women these days are having heart attacks, I think. Is that true?
That's correct.
So how and it's been publicized quite a bit that their symptoms are different than men. Tell us how do they manifest themselves?
So it's interesting. What we see is women present with what we call atypical symptoms, which means that it's not the classic somebody sitting on my chest and I'm short of breath and what have you. And this is probably not because they're women, but because women tend to have heart attacks older than men do. And the older that you get, the more atypical your symptoms are. If you're a 45-year-old male, your symptoms are very different than a 75-year-old male.
And the same it's age-related.
It's age-related, probably more than gender-related. We used to think it might be gender-related, but the more we look at it, it's probably because women have heart attacks later in life than men. So we see what we call anginal equivalence. That's a fancy term for things that are like chest pain but are not exactly chest pain. So the shortness of breath that we talked about without anything else, the sweating without anything else, the sense of unwellness or flushing, those types of things may occur with or without chest pain. So older women and older men, when they present with heart attacks, sometimes will present with these things that are equivalent to chest pain but aren't chest pain. And they're more vague and they're more non-localizing, which means I can't point to exactly where they're coming from.
But they just feel unwell.
They feel unwell. You may have shortness of breath, which is one of the big ones that when we look at the epidemiological studies of women who have heart attacks, shortness of breath is one of the more common symptoms. I'm short of breath. I wasn't short of breath, but now I just can't breathe. I don't know why. I just feel uncomfortable. And it doesn't have that chest pain component, but if suddenly I can't breathe, that's certainly concerning to me.
Sounds like that symptom alone would send anyone who's trying to seek medical help. And similarly, a crushing chest pain would. Tell us what you should, if you were with somebody who says that they're suffering from chest pain, what would you do or what should you tell that person?
Sure. I think the first thing that you want to do, if somebody's suffering from chest pain bad enough to bring it to your attention, I think you're going to want to sit them down, make sure they're not exerting themselves. And then you're going to want to call an ambulance to come see that patient, or that your friend or your loved one or what have you. If somebody has chest pain bad enough that they need to tell you about it, then I think you need to come to the hospital to be evaluated for it. Certainly if you've never had this before in the past. So I think what you should tell them is to sit down, not exert themselves, because if the heart is trying to work hard and you're having a heart attack and it's trying to work to keep up with everything, but you can't get enough blood supply to it, the best thing to do is to not make it work as hard and try to calm it down. If you have things on hand and you know the person's not allergic, like aspirin, you can give an aspirin to them. It's the same thing the paramedics will do when they see you. And otherwise, just calling 911 and getting them to the hospital is the most important thing.
But an ambulance is the key.
I think an ambulance is the key because an ambulance has interventions that we can give early. Things like antiplatelet agents like aspirin, and they can even get an EKG. And nowadays, they can transmit that EKG to the hospital. So I can see before you even arrive whether you're having a heart attack and have all the right people ready for you before you even come.
And that's crucial because minutes make a difference.
Is. Yeah, what matters when we're having a heart attack is we want to get you to a cath lab and open up that blood vessel. And we used to think what mattered was when you got to the hospital, get you up to the cath lab right away, and this door to cath lab time was what mattered. When really what we find is the time from your first symptom to when you get to the cath lab is what matters. So from the first time I have chest pain, the quicker I get in, the better you'll do, because the less heart muscle you kill off. And in fact, when we worry about those types of things, it's not so much the death that we worry about that as well, but the more heart that you kill off, the more you may have things like morbidity from it. In other words, shortness of breath, congestive heart failure, difficulty doing the exercise and things you did beforehand. So the quicker we can get you up, the more likely we are to avoid those complications.
So the bottom line is you want to save as much heart muscle as possible. And so moments matter.
That's correct. That's correct. And especially from that first symptom that you have.
And clearly, if you try to drive somebody yourself to a hospital, you're really taking a great risk because that person could pass out while you're driving, you could have an accident, any number of things could happen. So the ambulance is crucial, plus all the additional care you get when you are in an ambulance. I don't want to run out of time, but very briefly, give us an overview of what happens when you come into the hospital in an ambulance with suspected heart attack or just chest pain.
Sure.
What happens?
Sure. We have a protocol, and what we want to do is as soon as we see you, we want to get an EKG, which is put the stickers across to look at the electrical conductivity of your heart within the first 5 minutes of you being there. So even if you walked in to the emergency department and you said, I have chest pain, you're going to be immediately brought into a room and have an EKG, and a physician is going to look at it within a minute of you having it. It's not just the nurse, the physician will see it as well. So that's going to happen. The first thing you're going to do is get that, and then we'll determine a lot based upon that, because we can determine by looking at that, are you having a heart attack? Are you having ischemia, which means are you not having a heart attack, but you're not getting enough oxygen to your heart? Are you having pericarditis? And we're going to put an IV in you, and we're going to draw some blood work to see if there's anything in the blood that's leaked out from damaged heart tissue.
And bottom line is, if necessary, you'll be admitted or whatever is necessary to be done.
Yes.
So the bottom line is, if you have chest pain and you're worried about it at all, call 911.
That's correct.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in. This is very helpful information and crucial information. My guest has been Dr. William Paolo. He's assistant professor of emergency medicine at Upstate Medical University, and he's the residency program director as well. Thanks so much again for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Neal, an editor of The Healing Muse. There is a wonderful poet from our upstate New York area named Joan Cofrancesco. She sent us some poems about life in the waiting room while someone she loves is undergoing heart surgery. Her poem reminds me how we become experts in biological and medical subjects that once were arcane and unknown, but now seduce us with their power to heal. Here is Waiting Room, Joan Cofrancesco. Epigram says, the heart, which is the bastion of life, is the repository of the past. Rainy and dark out, I'm in the waiting room, listening to Mozart on my iPad, surrounded by warriors, time in my lap. They are taking the vein, the saphenous vein. They will use it to make a detour around the blocked area to the artery. The heart beats 72 times a minute, 100,000 times a day, 36 million times a year, 2.5 billion times during a lifetime. They call me to say the operation has started. A stainless steel saber saw buzzes in the background. I imagine you floating above the stretcher, one of Chagall's lovers, watching them open your chest. Every day, the heart creates enough energy to drive 20 miles, and a lifetime is equal to driving to the moon and back. They call me to say he is on bypass. The heart weighs 11 ounces, pumps 2,000 gallons of blood through 60,000 miles of vessels each day. Like Rilke's Black Panther, I pace the white halls of the hospital. I catch glimpses of death carrying a glass cane decorated with skeletons and bones. He's in black scrubs with a black designer surgical cap. He is all business.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn about what to eat to stay healthy, more about menopause, and how to find joy again after devastating heartbreak. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink On Air, all one word, .org. And if you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.